Interview with Mike Sully, March 17th, 2012. First, I would like to thank you for taking part in this interview, and I would like to ask you if I have your permission to record this.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Could we begin with a brief introduction about yourself and your military career? When did you join the army, and what determined you to?
Sure, absolutely. I was shanghaied by the military in 1995 when I attempted to join the military college. They had just closed down the Victoria Royal Military College, or Royal Roses it was called, and so they sent me off to the Canadian Scottish Regiment. I participated in training with the reserves while I was going to the University of Victoria, and stayed on afterwards while I completed multiple overseas tours, two to Bosnia-Herzegovina, two into Afghanistan, and kept it up while I was finishing my master's degree at Royal Roads University. I eventually did make it back there. And here I am today, 15 years later.
When did you find out that you will be sent to former Yugoslavia, and what was the reaction?
At first I was actually quite relieved. We had heard that they'd be taking soldiers overseas. This is 1999 while I was doing my leadership training out in Wainwright, Alberta. And I had expressed an interest to deploy overseas, and they said, yep, you've got a spot. But upon finishing training in the summer, I came back only to find that there was only one spot and they were sending another soldier. So I re-enrolled back into University of Victoria, and then 28 days later I got told that no, in fact, I would be going to the former Yugoslavia and that I needed to go to Edmonton within 5 days. So I had to withdraw from my classes, try and get some of my tuition money back, and head off to Edmonton for 5 months of training before we deployed early 2000.
What rank were you at the time?
I was a corporal in the infantry with all of my leadership qualifications.
Could you tell me a bit about your pre-deployment training?
Absolutely. My pre-deployment training took place with 3rd Battalion, Princess Patricia's Canadian Light Infantry, PPCLI, which is an infantry unit. And it started off with us going out to Wainwright, Alberta, where we started off doing all of our collective training leading towards live fire attacks. So making sure that we were aware of landmines, how to get yourself out of a minefield, how to spot the signs of being in a minefield, emergency driving, and of course a lot of marksmanship. So training with our rifles, our service rifles rather, and escalating up to doing a live fire attack. So of course at first we started on a static, very conventional range, just shooting targets, and from there you move up to advancing on an enemy in a trench with a fire team partner, and it escalates from there. Once we returned from Edmonton, or correction, from Wainwright back to Edmonton, we did pre-deployment training exercise where they superimposed the area of operations that we'd be operating in over top of a map of the areas north of Edmonton. And with the permission of a lot of the local civilians, we actually went about and we did an exercise north of Edmonton for 5 days, where we drove in and about through the villages and we conducted patrols, resupplies, and the task that we thought we'd be doing when we got to Bosnia.
I would also like to ask you about the objective of in the store. What was basically, you were part of NATO, you said?
Yes, by this time, of course, the peacekeeping mission had changed over to NATO, and a lot of the fighting, well, practically all of the fighting, of course, had died down. So there was a lot of veterans in our unit that had been there during tours with the UN. So they had a realistic understanding of what the people were like and what situations we could find ourselves in, and in that way they helped to shape the training. So at this time, of course, we expected to train for war, but be very much ready to do a very benign peacekeeping tour.
What were the rules of engagement of NATO, and how were they different than the UN?
I can't speak to the UN, however, because of course I did not serve with them, but I did sense a lot of frustration with some of the older veterans in that they felt very constrained by the rules of engagement that they were given underneath the auspices of the UN that did not allow them to intervene when they saw life and limb being risked, when they saw civilians being killed or executed or murdered or anything of that nature. The NATO rules of engagement were about 5 pages long, but of course they were very good to the soldier in that, of course, we'd be allowed to use deadly force at any cost to protect our lives or the lives of civilians or other military people of other coalition forces. And it went on also to designate down to when you could shoot, when you couldn't shoot, what equipment was designated as a special status, or rather what people had a special status and they could be defended with lethal force, what equipment you were allowed to shoot people for if they tried to steal them, i.e. Cryptography or cryptographical equipment with the radio systems, and sort of what uses of force were authorized in different situations. A lot of our training, of course, was considered rules of engagement or ROE training, and they would give scenarios at us, and we would talk it through, we would act them out to try, again, put us in situations which we could encounter in situations overseas.
Were the objectives clear once you got there?
They were, absolutely. I mean, of course, we'd built on the experiences of Canadians having been there for, you know, up to 10 years, so we knew very well what we'd be getting into, and a lot of people were fairly clear on the types of situations that we would find ourselves in, dealing with locals, dealing with the police over there, dealing with the military, dealing with other coalition partners.
So you said you were deployed there in early 2000?
Yeah, early 2000. I believe I landed on the ground about 20th of February 2000, and I left just early September of 2000. So I was there just about 6 months, a little shy of 6 months.
Do you remember where you were camped?
Absolutely. I was camped in Tomislavgrad, which is near the border with the Republic of Hrvatska or Croatia, about 2 hours from the city of Split. We can find it on the map here, just south of Livno and just east of Split. It was a largely Christian area. The people there had sort of direct connection with Croatia because, of course, they consider themselves, you know, part of the same
ethnicity. Do you remember your first mission, and did you feel prepared?
Absolutely. I was one of the last fellows to arrive in the section. By that time, my section commander and leadership had been there for about a week, so they'd had a chance to do a handover with the French that we took over from. It was a new camp that we moved into. It was one that had been just created by the Dutch and handed over to Canadians, so we were lucky to have been the first people in that area. So we were fairly excited to see how the locals would react and, of course, go on a first mission. I don't remember my first mission all that clearly, but I do remember within hours of landing on the ground, I was fired in the back of an armored personnel carrier, and we went up north to the military camp, not Drvar. That's where the headquarters camp was, so that we could go and zero our weapons, which meant fire the weapons on a range to make sure that all of our scopes were zeroed and that our weapon systems were dialed in. I remember this quite clearly because I got quite sick because of the water, maybe the food, maybe a bug, and I spent most of my time puking on the range.
So what could you tell me about the everyday life as a soldier in former Yugoslavia? What were your responsibilities? What were your duties? What do you have to do?
Right. Everyday life was actually quite slow. I had been prepared for quite an active time, but in reality, there was a lot of waiting around and a lot of time spent in camp. Depending what our task was, and there was usually three tasks, you were either tasked on patrol, you were tasked with quick reaction force duties, or else you were tasked with security at camp, and I'll go through each one of those. If you were tasked with patrol, not a lot of information came down with this organization, so we would basically just get told what time to meet at the armored personnel carrier, we'd get a quick ground briefing of where we'd be heading for the day, and whether we'd be mounted the whole time within the vehicle, just patrolling, or if we had planned to stop somewhere and dismount, maybe have a coffee, interact with the locals. Most of our missions took place around the area of Kuprej, which was about an hour north of Tomislavgrad, on a big plateau. It was lightly populated, some small villages, a lot of farming, and the only main city in the area would have been Kuprej, which was not very big. If we were tasked with quick reaction force, essentially you'd do a garbage sweep of the camp, and you would make sure that all your kit equipment was good to go so that you could support a friendly call sign or a friendly organization if they got into trouble, if they needed to get towed, or if they needed extraction, or if they got into a gunfight, which, of course, never happened. So a day spent on quick reaction force was usually quite slow. And, of course, if we were at security of the camp, we'd spend time up in the guard towers making sure that we had 360-degree visibility, and we also controlled the front entry points and the rear entry points to the camp as well.
Did you feel safe most of the time, or you felt that your life was threatened?
I absolutely felt safe the entire time. We had a walkout policy in the camp, not for recreation, but as long as you had at least one pistol with you and you had a fire team partner, you could actually leave the camp and go for a run, or you could even sign out two of the mountain bikes and go for a quick bike ride. As I was training for half marathons at the time, I'd go out for some very long runs, and never once did I ever feel that my life was in any danger. The biggest threat to us, as I told you earlier, of course, would have been the ever and very real present threat of landmines.
That's one of the subject I would like to touch. What could you tell me about this, the mining missions of the fields? And
absolutely. Being an infantry soldier, we just had a basic training in landmines. Of course, we were taught to recognize the different types of anti-personnel landmines and the different types of anti-tank landmines. We were told how they detonate. We were told how many of the warring factions had planted landmines and what to look for. Of course, by this time, a lot of the fields, of course, were marked as minefields, but we also knew that a lot of the minefields that had been laid had been done in a very hasty fashion and not documented. So for the most part, we stayed off of the grass at all times. There were civilian and UN demining organizations all throughout the area of operations. We didn't do very much work with them, but certainly we saw them around.
What were the purposes of the mines, and who were the ones that planted the mines?
I guess it depends on what day of the week it was in Bosnia who planted them. Depending who was fighting in the area, of course, they would have planted them hastily to either, you know, start or stop or halt enemy advance, or it could have been to harass and kill civilians. The mine's an indiscriminate weapon, for sure.
What was your military kit, if I may ask?
Yeah, kit and equipment. It was a pretty simple load if we were going on either a foot patrol or a vehicle patrol. We had not planned to stay overnight. Essentially, we'd have a little bag we keep with us, which would have our helmets and our armored plates in them. But most of the time, we did not wear that. We'd wear our soft hat, which would be just a floppy hat to keep the sun off. And we'd have our service rifle with us. We'd have 5 magazines of 30 rounds each, 2 grenades, 1 smoke grenade, and the second in command and the section commander would have a pistol. With our carrier itself, of course, we had rockets, a 50 cal machine gun, a 30 cal machine gun, or a C6, as well as shoulder fired recoilless rifles, or rather rocket launchers, and grenades. So a lot of firepower with the armored personnel carrier when we were off on our own, enough to get in a gunfight and extract ourselves if required, but of course we never had a situation where we had to fire a shot.
What about, do you encounter any specific situations when you encounter landmines and you felt threatened?
Never felt threatened. We did on occasion find landmines, and of course what we'd do was we would mark the area near the road. So if we saw one on patrol, we would just get a grid or a 10-figure grid on a GPS of actually where the closest point to that landmine was on the road. We'd mark it off with white spray paint on the road with some information, jot it down, and we'd pass that along to the engineers after our patrol. And that's about the... Sorry, I do have one story about feeling a little bit threatened. We were doing some emergency driving training up near Bihać, and we were each taking a turn to drive the armored personnel carrier. This area was highly marked as being inundated with landmines, and while we were driving, one of the new drivers actually took the armored personnel carrier off the road by accident and was driving with 3 wheels in the ditch, and he was literally running over minefield signs. So we corrected that fault. We carried on with the patrol, and several weeks later, once the snow melted, we saw that the farmers were out in the field harvesting it, getting ready for the plant seeds. So the mine signs were there, but clearly the farmers and locals felt no threat. So at the end of the day, we may have been just crying wolf.
Did you try to warn them, or they would just wouldn't listen?
No, they had tractors and they had equipment. It was a pretty high-speed operation, so, and they could see the minefields as clearly as we could, so we just jotted it down in our patrol report. We weren't going to go in and try and stop them to talk to them, as they obviously felt quite safe and secure in the area. And as far as I know, throughout our 6 months there, there never was an incident in that particular area with landmines, so they clearly knew where the landmines were and where they weren't.
What about the... We talked before about the mission to capture illegal weapons from the locals, and did you face any resistance in this, or did you have any specific capture?
We did some Operation Harvest. They were called, Operations Vetsva, where we'd go out with the British, and we would ask people to voluntarily turn in weapons, landmines, and explosives. We did some small successes in 2000, where we did end up with some weapons and some explosives, some landmines. I don't recall specifics on that, but it wasn't very often that we did these operations. We'll talk later about 2002, 2003, where we did them on a weekly basis, and we certainly had a lot more success searching homes. Again, where we were in Kuprej, Thomas Lovgrad, not a lot of people, and most people, although very friendly with us, interacted well. We certainly didn't go into their houses to search for weapons.
Why would they bother to have weapons in their homes?
I can only speak on my own opinion, but I would say that probably for security reasons. Even though there was a international peacekeeping force in the area, Bosnia is a big country, and some of the areas we got to, we'd been the first peacekeepers people had seen in quite some time. So even though we were there, we certainly weren't everywhere, and neither were the police or the local militaries as well. So I think that a certain amount of lawlessness was still rampant.
Did you find any more of artillery weapons, hidden artillery weapons, or anti-aircraft?
No. Probably our biggest find, actually, was we were doing a helicopter reconnaissance right between the border of our area of operations and the Dutch, so right north of Kuprej near Bogonjo. Now we found what looked to be a local military defensive position. So we scrambled a quick operation with the engineers, and our company rolled on up to find out what was going on and lock it down. And it turns out it was a perfectly legitimate cantonment site, which is what they called all the military places, where a certain amount of people and equipment and weapons were allowed to train and exist. But in the handover, it had actually been lost. So they hadn't seen peacekeepers in over half a year. And it was fairly successful when we searched the place, as we did manage to get a fair amount of weapons and ammunition and equipment that wasn't on the cantonment register. As well, we found radio logs that showed that they had been reporting on international peacekeeping traffic up and down the main highways. So even though they were allowed to be there, they certainly hadn't seen us in a long time and were conducting their own surveillance of our operations.
What was the the attitude of the locals, of the army, and of the policemen towards the Canadian NATO soldier? Were they cooperating? Were they friendly? Were they hostile?
They certainly cooperated with us whenever we were doing our missions, and outwardly they were quite friendly. As to what they were thinking, I'm not 100% sure, of course. I know we had another operation where the military was training in a training area, and they didn't have permission to do so from NATO. So we had to go in, of course, shut them down, and the commander was fairly hostile to us. He had, he felt that it was his training area, it was his country, he should be able to train when he wants. However, at the end, he did comply with us.
Did you have local translators, and were they trustworthy?
We did. As far as we can tell, they were trustworthy, of course. That being said, we still had a certain amount of operational security, so there's certain things we wouldn't tell our interpreters, of course, until we're actually launched. For instance, when we went up to search that cantonment site, our interpreters obviously knew that something was happening because we had our helmets on, we had our ballistic eyewear, and our armor on, which we didn't normally operate in. So, of course, they were fairly excited. We said, no, it's okay. Just come into the carrier. We'll tell you once we get going. And once we got going and told them what was going on, they understood. They didn't take it personally that, of course, we couldn't tell them certain things.
Could we move on to 2002?
Absolutely. 2002, 2003. In Edmonton, of course, again, for workup training, this time it was 6 to 6.5 months long. In the middle of our workup training, there was a G8 summit in Kananaskis, Alberta, where we had to do security, so that was a nice segue in our training. I would say for this particular tour, the training was a little bit more in-depth in terms of individual soldier skill development. So we started off in Edmonton. We went off to Wainwright, Alberta for a solid month of gun camp, really. So every day we'd march out to the range and we'd train up on our weapon systems from grenades, pistols, rockets, machine guns, light, medium, and our rifles. And again, we'd start off on a conventional range shooting targets and then move up towards doing live fire attacks. So we went up to doing platoon live fire attacks, which means 36 guys closing on enemy objective, all shooting different types of weapon systems and advancing. And we moved up after that to doing a company attack dry, which means using blank and simulated ammunition and not real live ammunition going downrange. After that, of course, we took part in this G8 security summit and then went back to Wainwright where we ran ranges for the other units to train up. And we did some individual courses as well, driving courses and things like that. We did have our final exercise took place again. It was stand-based, which meant that we trained mostly on the camp in Edmonton where we do different scenarios. We rehearsed being stuck in a minefield, extracting yourself, dealing with locals, and things like that. When we deployed north to the Muslim enclave known as Bihać, where there had been a lot of fighting with the Serbs, with the Croatians, and the Muslims, of course. I had trained to be a section second in command, but shortly before deployment, another sergeant was let go, so I ended up with his section. So I ended up being a commander of a 12-man infantry section, and we had three light vehicles, light VW Jeeps. So we were no longer armored personnel carriers. The other units were. We ended up with Jeeps, which was a fantastic vehicle for the area because it was fairly mountainous, lots of valleys, ravines, lots of little goat trails, but the Iltis Jeep was capable of going just about everywhere.
So you were mentioning Bihać. Was there still any more ethnic tension between the population?
There may have been some ethnic tension, but for the most part, everybody was friendly and cooperative and it seemed to be getting along. I mean, just outside of Bihać, and you could see very visible signs of the fighting. As back at Tomislavgrad, too, there was a lot of battle damage, a lot of POC buildings where bullets had gone into. But Bihać even more so, because, of course, I believe they were held under siege for quite some time. Just shortly outside of Bihać, there's mosques, but then you go one village over, and, of course, there's a Catholic church. So in terms of tension, we didn't see it, but it did certainly seem like there was a very visible ethnic grouping still. If there was a village that was Muslim, it was Muslim. If there was a village that was Croatian Catholic, they were Catholic. I don't believe we saw too many villages that were openly Orthodox, but all you had to do, of course, was get closer to Banja Luka, of course, to see that in the Republic of Srpska.
So now in 2002, what were the objectives? Did the objectives change in any way, or?
The objectives hadn't changed anywhere, but of course it was quite a different area of operations and a different mandate too, in that our particular company commander was very focused on this whole idea of seizing weapons, seizing landmines, seizing explosives from the local populace. So we were a lot more busy as well. In 2000, as I said, it felt quite slow, and there was many days when we didn't leave the camp. But in 2002, 2003, we were extremely busy. We had a 16-day rotation where you do 4 days on camp security. That never changes, of course. You're working the gate, you're checking civilians, you're checking vehicles that they go out on patrol, ensuring that the camp is secure. You would spend 4 days on quick reaction force, which, of course, again, is being ready to assist another friendly unit. But on top of this, the quick reaction force was also responsible on a daily basis of going to visit the police chief and getting any weapons that they had taken in, as well as going up to an active cantonment site where they had missiles to ensure that the seals had not been broken on the missile silos. There was a military unit, I believe it was 6th Corps, located in the same town of Bihać, so we'd also go and do cantonment site visits as well. And we'd spend 4 days on patrol. And with a little Jeep, we were very busy going all over the place, doing village assessments, checking up on people, and on a weekly basis we would do a larger operations, either platoon or company, where we'd lock down a village or an area or a section of town, and we'd start searching homes for, again, weapons, explosives, and landmines. And we were fairly successful, and we resulted in seizing many, many, many firearms, mostly AK-47s.
And do you know any idea where did they get those weapons from?
For the most part, again, I believe that they were left over from the fighting and from the war. It was very rare we would come across a brand new weapon. The only instance of a brand new weapon was a brand new Glock that we seized from two old people who insisted that it was okay because their son was a cop. And, of course, we replied, you know, here's your receipt for the weapon. If he can come and claim it within 15 days, it will be held at this camp. We'd be happy to give it back to him. Otherwise, it will be destroyed. And sure enough, he came back, and he was a legitimate police officer that had been on vacation and left his pistol at home.
What was I about to ask? Do you feel that the previous UN missions were successful, and do you feel that those made your job easier there? Do you feel that it was more stable?
I think they must have been successful because we did have such a cooperative, friendly environment. Even when people didn't want us to be there or search their homes, of course, they were still compliant. Clearly, there were lots of us. But compared to some of the things we see in Afghanistan, in terms of cooperation that's hiding insurgents and actively complicit in in attacking coalition forces. We didn't see anything like that in Bosnia at all. So yes, I would. My opinion is that the UN mission was successful, at least in terms of stabilizing the country and the open warring factions. We also, of course, knew that there was lots of crime, lots of organized crime, lots of smuggling of people and drugs and cigarettes through. But of course, that wasn't our mandate.
So even if the NATO forces would have witnessed a smuggling or anything, they couldn't do anything about it?
I won't comment on that, but clearly, I mean, if we saw a person being smuggled, then that would be something that we would stop. If we, you know, caught somebody smuggling drugs or weapons, then yes, absolutely, we would stop that. But we'd bring in the local police and the international police to actually deal with the follow-on effect of that. We would stop the situation, stabilize it, we'd detain and hand over.
So do you think that overall the UN and / NATO missions over there were quite a success in stabilizing the...
I would have to say in terms of stabilizing the environment so that people could grow up without, or at least people could return to the area and rebuild, I would say mostly yes.
Do you feel that the population was happy with what was happening, or they were still loyal to old Yugoslavia, or...
I think that's a pretty tricky question, and you have to take a look at different generations. I think certainly the younger folk were more willing to get along. I think a lot of the older folk may have been more set in their ways from the fighting. A lot of terrible things happened. I think there was a lot of grudges there, and I don't think everybody got a good deal when it came in terms of repopulating the area. Certainly people may have come in to a farm, rebuilt the house, started farming it, but it may not have been theirs. So I think there was still a fair amount of displacement happening as people were coming back from overseas or from where they had hidden out.
And you said you were never fired upon?
That's correct. There was, I think, maybe only one time on the whole tour we heard shots fired, and of course, discounting holidays, of course, when people would fire into the air. But we investigated it, and we didn't see any brass, no signs of anybody firing, so it could have just been something that was misreported by the security force on the camp.
What about, if I may ask, were there any casualties caused by mines in your regiment, or you don't recall?
No, that? Nobody in our regiment, nobody. At this time, I was with the 1st Battalion, PPCLI, and to my knowledge, certainly nobody was hurt by landmines on that tour. If there were any injuries, they would have been just caused by accident, but certainly not by landmines.
Accident as in traffic accident?
Yeah, exactly. It could have been a traffic accident, a rollover, maybe something dropped on somebody in a camp, but nothing that was ever brought to my attention.
So how was the comradeship between the UN soldiers, and you mentioned also there were Dutch people, NATO forces in your area?
They were great, actually. Like I said, we took over from, I believe, the Dutch in Tomislavgrad back in 2000, and we eventually ended up having a small detachment of Dutch soldiers come back to us as they were working radio equipment, and they got along quite well, very good foosball players, and there was certainly no animosity between the different forces, and because it was an international mission, of course, no matter what camp you're in, there was always people traveling to and fro and coming in and out. We also tried to do exchanges, so in 2000, I ended up becoming a section commander for a week in the area of Mekonosgrad near Banja Luka, and we patrolled the British area of operations. My section did in 2003, they did a exchange again with the British while I was on vacation or on leave. But we had other sections do exchanges with the Romanians. We had them do them with the Dutch and the Americans.
What could you tell me about the leaves? Were you allowed to go in a specific city that you chose, or you were destined to?
We basically were given 2 4-day R&Rs, as well as, I believe, an 18-day vacation. For the 2 R&Rs, a rest relaxation, as it was called, they had areas that were set up to receive soldiers, so you could pick from a list of 5 or 6 different cities where they had a small center set up that would book you a room in a hostel or hotel, as well as recommended things to do. But you didn't have to go with those. You could basically, you were free. They would move you to a main center, either Zagreb or to Split, and from there you were on your own if you wanted. So in my first tour, I went to Hungary, to Budapest, and I also went to, I don't recall. I went somewhere else for my second R&R. I went down to the beach in Croatia, down to a small place called just south of Split. The name escapes me. For my 18-day one, of course, they would fly people back home to Canada. But if you wished, you could take the money that they would spend on a ticket for you, and you could put that towards travel to go to different areas. So many people like myself just went to Italy or Greece or other areas close by. Because we were so close to Split, near the end of the tour, we were authorized one day trip down to Split to do a bit of relaxation for a day, and we took advantage of that as well.
So how many tours did you do in total?
I've done four tours in total, but I did two in Bosnia-Herzegovina.
Is there anything more that you remember specifically from this tour that occurred to you and they just...
had an epiphany? I would say, I think we talked about this earlier, was just sort of an assessment on the security situation took place during 2002, 2003, when I had an acquaintance from Victoria that had been traveling most of Eastern Europe, actually showed up on our camp doorstep in Bihać. She had run into a soldier of mine in Split. They got along famously, and he thought, I'm going to go up and see what's happening. And he got on a bus from Split and came all the way up to Bihać, overnighted in the civilian bus station. It was very stormy that night. And then walked right through the town, asking where S4 was, and they kept getting pointed to our direction and eventually ended up on our doorstep. And, of course, here's a civilian backpacking across Europe. No weapons, no security precautions, really, except for your usual traveling ones, and he was never in any danger or trouble. So
there's another example that...
Very safe.
It was, right.
Absolutely. I know, certainly, Bosnia was rated as being a very dangerous place at night there, but we did a lot of our operations at night, and if stuff was happening, of course, we didn't see it.
Did the NATO forces also do border patrols or at the checkpoints between borders?
Mm-hmm.
Could you tell me a bit more about that?
Yeah, we did one border check. Well, in 2000, of course, we used to just go to the border and check to ensure that that there was still security up there. We didn't interact with them at all. We had quite a few border crossings near Bihać, so sometimes we would just drive up, take a look around, report what was going on, and come back. But once we did an operation, we were searching grain trucks and box trucks as they came from Croatia into Bosnia. Probably within about 5 minutes of setting up, every truck driver in the area was on their CB or on the radio. So, of course, we didn't catch anything, but we certainly did search a lot of trucks. And people were fairly hostile to us because as we broke customs and security seals, they knew that their loads may be turned around at the other end or else they'd have to pay a fine for having their security seals and their customs tags broken.
You also mentioned you went to Republika Srpska.
That's right.
How was now the situation there that they had a new government, they were now a republic?
That I can't even speak on. My brother was posted there for 6 months. I just went over there for the day, so I didn't have a chance to interact with the population. When I spent a week in Mikonochgrad in 2000, we patrolled some areas that hadn't seen peacekeepers in a very long time. We took the carry up into some, and the jeeps up into some back roads and got a good chance to explore. But in terms of the political situation at the time, I can't speak to that.
Do you remember your last day in former Yugoslavia and how was the reaction? Was it a relief?
By that point, I suppose I was happy to be going home. We had just handed over to a new unit. We had sent most of our soldiers back, and I stayed along to do a handover with the incoming unit. I suppose at the same time, too, I didn't necessarily want to hand over my area to new guys who I didn't feel were as well trained as I was, even though, of course, they would have been just fine and just as well trained. But you certainly have a sense of, not ownership, but you certainly have a sense of having operated in the same area for 6 months with the same interpreters, talking to the same police, the same military people, a lot of local civilians. You do have a certain sense of belonging to the area. So, of course, it's always sad to leave.
And Was there any difficulty to reintegrate back to civilian life when you came to Canada?
No, I didn't find any difficulty reintegrating. Of course, it's a bit like a kid in a candy store because you're allowed to drink again and do all the engage in all the vice that you engaged in before you went overseas. But for the most part, no, there was no issues.
Is there any one specific thing that marked you as a person from this war theater?
I don't think so.
And overall, you would say that the situation was stable, and do you think that NATO's mission there, and of course the previous UN, were a great success in stabilizing the area?
Right. In terms of their mandate, which was a stabilization force, I think they were successful.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Yes.
You've answered all my questions.
All right.
Thank you for taking part in this program.
Again, it's my pleasure. Good luck.
Thank you.